begin the day with a friendly voice, a companion unobtrusive. Hello, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people who think about pop culture too much. I'm Andrew Harrison, and helping me out, as usual, is Sean Pattenden, the soulful and enigmatic peaches to my workman-like herb. Hello, Sean, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew.
Nice bank holiday?
It was great, thank you very much.
I'm delighted to hear it. I see you're getting very excited about Eurovision. Can you give us some tips for runners and riders? Who should we be watching?
Well, I still think Israel are going to win with Netta, who looks like a cross between Björk and Beth Ditto, and swore a lot yesterday live on TV.
Did she swear in English?
She swore in English, and there were a lot of complaints. She wasn't meant to be swearing because that's not actually in the song, but she's very good and she does a chicken impression in the song a few times.
So this is the Israeli Eurovision Bill Grundy moment that we've all been waiting for all of our lives.
It's as near as we can get.
What's the song like?
Mainly she's pretending to be a chicken.
Is she the Israeli King Kurt? Is that...
Almost. We're almost there. But there's a bit of kind of hip-hop which DJs in the video as well. She's doing all things to all people. But she is really quite exciting. And compared to a lot of them who are mere children, there were some boys singing songs to girls. And they're all 2 years old, because obviously I'm not getting any older. I think she's got a bit of a chance, actually.
Does Britain have a ghost of a chance? Because they'll hate us, don't they, because of Brexit. Is our song crap as usual?
Our song is called Storm, and it is basically We Can Weather the Storm, i.e. Brexit. Look, just forgive us. And then Ireland is called Together. So it's like Ireland's going, but we need to be together. We still need to be together. And we're saying We Can Weather the Storm. They're desperately Brexit, both of those songs.
Well, when we've left the Eurovision, when we've left the European
Which
Union,
is next
we'll
year.
Have to leave Eurovision.
Yeah, next year we won't be allowed in, I presume.
All this conversation just totally reinforces my idea that this entire country should be putting special measures for the next 12 months, like a failing school. We should just parachute in some superhead to resolve it.
Well, you're hearing ghost voices from the future there. Sean, would you like to introduce some of our special guests?
Of course I would. I think you heard him just there. He writes for The Guardian, The Sunday Times, edits the art magazine Supplement, and runs the high-end arts photography publisher No UFOs. And he's generally a good egg about town. He matches fine taste in the visual arts with truly terrible taste in awful heavy metal music. It's Big Mouth regular Justin Quirk. Hello, Justin. How are you?
Hi, Sean. I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
You've just published a thing we heard called Battle Jacket. What is it?
It's Battle Jacket number one.
Ah, Battle Jacket number one. Okay.
This has been a year-long photographic study of the sleeveless denim jackets covered in patches, which you still find in abundance at heavy metal shows. So started about a year ago, going to gigs all over London and photographing these wherever they found. Because the idea is that I think one thing I really like in kind of art is really pointless works of folk art, and these things that people labour enormous amounts of care and attention on with absolutely no hope of sort of financial reward. And because there was this sort of thing in the past where, you know, being in the avant-garde is actually quite an uncomfortable place to be, and it wasn't swanking around Evening Standard dinners and, you know, going to things in Mayfair. And that's obviously rather sort of gone now in art, in that that's entirely what most people are aiming for. So I have these sort of newly found reserves of affection for people who just go out and do these absolutely pointless projects that they may spend years on, and, you know, no sort of obvious reward other than having this thing to wear. So ended up shooting about 80 of these things at various sort of shows. Everyone I met was lovely. Their mums were involved very heavily in the stitching, because I think their giant heavy metal sort of dumpies, rusty nuts thumbs weren't too good at that kind of thing.
And, were you surprised that anyone actually crafted a jacket themselves, stitched it on?
No one really admitted to that. Most of them were quite candid about, you know, not being particularly good on the seamstress front.
Roping in
mums and rather long-suffering partners. But there were, you know, there's some genuinely sort of beautiful works of art there, and people have literally spent years putting these things together. And it's got the certain patches and things just go for huge amounts of money now. Oh, wow. And, you know, obviously people tracking down kind of historical ones and ones from sort of early 80s Donington festivals.
What should the listeners be looking in their cupboards for then on the rare badge patch front?
Do you know what? Pretty much anything pre-1990. They're quite broad churches, because what you generally get is a complete swathe of bands, but then you'd have like a random one, like an ABBA patch or something, but then also non-music ones. So like British Rail patches come up quite a lot. So
RSPB.
That's quite cool.
Yeah, and then we know weird ones like that, and swimming badges often sort of pop in.
Well, brownie badges, are we getting into cubs?
I didn't see any of that.
Okay, but checking.
I went to see Suede at Ali Pali once, and somebody had a patch on the bum of their jeans was the 1980s Doctor Who logo, and the kind of neon-y one, and I thought, probably only me and you in this room of 10,000 people who have any idea what that is.
That little-known underground show, Doctor Who.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was in the 80s, exactly. But I was into it when it was rubbish.
I was in it when it was rubbish. Anyway, that's another story, isn't
that
it?
That is another story.
How's your book about hair metal coming on, Justin?
Well, this is all part of my grand heavy metal Ponzi scheme, because at the moment, right. If you want the Battle Jacket book, okay. The limited edition, it's only 100 copies, but you have to pledge on the other ongoing crowdfunder to get hold of it. So that is called Nothing But A Good Time. It's a cultural history of the rise and fall of glam metal. So it's essentially the story of America in the 80s told through the prism of ludicrous big hair spandex metal, which I still maintain is the great lost genre of music.
Yeah.
It was enormous. It broke all kinds of boundaries. It was genuinely a huge mainstream concern, and you never ever meet anyone nowadays who goes, do you know what, I was really into Dokken. You know, someone was, but it's sort of looking back, because I think it appears to still be the one kind of music which is considered beyond the pale in terms of commercial or serious reassessment or rehabilitation.
Lemon Duran Duran.
No, but people know. Well, you know, Robert Elms will quack on till the cows come home about neo-romantics. You know, Simon Reynolds will write endless pieces about, you know, very reductive GABA records. Stuart Home writes about Oi. Anyway, objectively, I'd say this is no more or less stupid than any of these things. And as I've had this argument with Andrew before, if you will make the case for British glam, which is ugly working class men troweling on the makeup and being as offensive as possible, I think it's very difficult to then not at least allow Poison their moment in the sun.
So remind the listeners, what's this book called and where can they investigate?
It's called Nothing But A Good Time. And if you go to the Unbound Books website, which is unbound.com, and just search for it there, it will reveal itself. There's a little 60-second film trailer that tells you all about it. So it's basically Adam Curtis with pyrotechnics.
Well, Justin will probably find a ready customer in our next guest who also loves the dreadful heavy metal of the 1980s. It's former Guardian music editor turned music writer for the FT, The Spectator, Uncut and Classic Rock, Michael Hann. Hello, Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew, very well. And on Battle Jackets, I went to see Iron Maiden last year in Nottingham, and I was struck by the number of people there wearing band-specific battle jackets. There was one family, you know, where mother, father and two kids were all wearing battle jackets with only Iron Maiden or related acts patches, including Blaze Bailey patches.
Wow.
Which that really is taking brand loyalty.
Who's related then? Are we talking like Paul Di'Anno's Battle Zone?
I bet there were Paul Di'Anno patches. It was the fact that they were willing to incorporate Blaze Bailey into their Iron Maiden battle jackets, because clearly sewn on after he'd left Maiden. And I know Andrew takes a very keen interest in the goings on of Iron Maiden.
I do.
And so I'm sure he will want to go onto a 20-minute splurge about how Blaze Bailey's tenure as singer as Iron Maiden was considered a disaster and has been pretty much written out of history.
I think
but
this
these
could
fans
be for the,
remained loyal.
This can be for the Big Mouth spin-off that you and
why is Andrew working? Making the universally recognised signal for lose that in the edit?
let's point out that Andrew, I think, was showing his two true colours in his introduction, where he quoted The Spirit of Radio by Rush.
I did that for you guys.
Come on, admit it, Andrew. You love a bit of prog.
I have never heard that song before I checked it on Spotify, and I thought, this is what people are so excited about.
I love that, and Michael and myself have basically staged a Momentum-style entry as plot into the Big Mouth podcast, and we're now destroying the host from the inside.
The only bit of Spirit of Radio I knew was the bit on the Saint Etienne album where it goes and then cuts to something much better.
What? Do, do,
no, no,
do,
no, no, do, no. Do, 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 Saint Etienne. Do, do, do. Before we abandon...
Oh, Saint Etienne cuts something better.
There's something better. Well, we could talk about heavy metal all day, and if we don't stop you, you will. Sean, what have we got on the show this week?
Well, thanks for asking that, Andrew. This week, we'll be looking at The Rain, a new post-apocalyptic series from Denmark. Surprise, surprise. Now showing on Netflix. Just how Hygge... Is it Hygge?
It's Hygge.
Hygge. Hygge. Hygge. Is this... Hygge. I'm going to say that all the next hour. Is this series about a virus that kills people horribly and leaves the planet on the brink of doom? And... What's the Sound of the Summer? Beach House's Woozy Bliss Out Tunes, DJ Cozy's Lazy Disco, or, yes, continuing the theme, Space Ambient Weirdness of John Hopkins. We'll find out right after this message.
As regular listeners know, we're asking for a little help to keep Big Mouth on the up and up. You can help to cover our studio expenses by buying us a notional symbolic virtual pint on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. If 120 listeners pledge just £5 a month, it'll cover all of our expenses. And once we hit the target, we'll start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. We will be very much in your debt, so go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. The link's also at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we are saying is, buy us a pint. Okay, The Rain, a dystopian thriller where Nordic noir meets young adult fiction, has just started on Netflix. In fact, it's the first Danish Netflix show, and it concerns a rain-borne virus which kills the majority of the population, leaving a few young survivors to sort it all out. It's a kind of Ertigetuva Dagasinera, that's 28 days later through Google Translate in Danish. Could we stand the rain against our TV window? We play the trailer, but it's in Danish. So, from the soundtrack, here's Tricky with Tribal Drums. Tribal Drums from the soundtrack to The Rain on Netflix. Now, this is essentially The Hunger Games meets 28 Days Later, with the fate of the world resting on young shoulders. The rain is poisonous and only the young people are left, and they're underground. And a young Danish girl has to look after her little brother, who is the key to it all. What do we think? Justin Quirk, is this your kind of thing? Is this your wheelhouse?
The premise is. I thought it was, it's interesting, the sort of post-apocalyptic premise. And it's quite a well-trodden path in that sort of post-apocalyptic fiction. There's an amazing Japanese book called Nip the Buds and Shoot the Kids that Kenzaburo Oe wrote in the 60s about a group of kids who get exiled from Tokyo during World War II. They're from a reform school. They're the last kids left whose parents haven't picked them up. And then they're stranded in this valley when all the adults disappear. So there's quite a long tradition. It's obviously Lord of the Flies, links back to all these things. I found this really, really hard to get motivated about in any way whatsoever. It's incredibly stagey. The acting I found was quite distancing in that way. I think it doesn't help that it's been dubbed quite clumsily.
Well,
which was really sad, 'cause you don't see that anymore.
Well, interestingly, we discovered, because we started watching it and going, this is dubbed, this is a lot of old shit. In Netflix options, you can take it back to the Danish and have British subtitles. And we watched it like that, and it was much more satisfying because you're not taken out of the action by the mouth totally out of sync with a bad dummy voice saying, but we're all going to die.
Yeah. We being experienced users of Netflix, managed to work out as soon as the first word was spoken, go into options, let's get the Danish audio. So, honestly, you...
Oh, I didn't know that. I absolutely didn't know that. Yeah. I watched
the Dutch version. So we've got two backers on this one show here. Did you not... I mean, I would have thought, as a man with your background, you would have dug the Danish design of the underground bunker a little bit. The Danish design's quite nice. The clothing's quite good.
I thought quite the opposite. I thought it was visually not interesting at all. And again, that's the kind of thing that irritates me, because that's not a question of budget. So, something like Moon, Duncan Jones's film, made a very low budget, but... visually had all these beautiful little, hidden tricks and, things with the typography. And this, I just thought it just looked a bit like they're in an underground car park with some camp beds put down. There was a few things that I found sort of distancing like that. There's a lot of exposition, particularly in the first episode, that may resolve sort of later into the series. And one thing I thought... they tried to integrate, and it actually made me think I'd be more interested in reading this as a book, because I could see it working. You could leave things more ambiguous there, but it has this perennial problem nowadays of how do you integrate communications technology into these kind of stories. Obviously Stranger Things bypassed that by putting things 30 years back in the past, so you didn't have this thing of, oh, okay, well, everyone's on mobiles and iPads. And they've tried to sort of integrate that in the story, and I'm not sure if anyone's really cracked that yet in terms of...
They sort of fix it by taking down all the networks, don't they? So to reintroduce the jeopardy.
But it sort of becomes... I don't know, because once that's there as an element in the story, you sort of think, well, either at some point the network's going to go down and... but it'll probably come back up at some point. Or, the phone will be there and you can... it's like the Deus Ex machine that you can get out by. So... I found a lot of the effects were just really kind of creaky in it. It reminded me a bit of sort of like the Boy from Space era children's drama from like the early mid 80s. Mm. I thought and by the end of it, I was just like, I really don't care if all these people get melted or not.
You weren't thrilled. No. Mike, what did you make of it?
I'm four episodes through because I'm devoted, and whenever I
dedicated
on these TV shows, you can't talk about one episode. But it became clear to me fairly on that it's all metaphorical. You've got these two kids who, by virtue of daddy, have sorted out fantastic luxury accommodation while they're besieged by people kept outside who are trying to get away from the rain and the horrific conditions it creates. Basically, it's about Glastonbury.
So they're in the VIP. They're in the yurt.
They're in the VIP yurt, and outside are all the people who are just having to tromp around in the mud, worried about the water getting into their boots and everything. Oh, yeah, it's completely what it's about. They've got catering as well. They've got ready-made catering in their luxury yurt.
And they've got a signal. Nobody else has got a signal. They're in the chill and charge.
I think that the problem with things like this is that there are so many of them. I mean, Justin said what it reminded him of. It reminded me of The Walking Dead meets The Road, you know. Mm-hmm. All these things are the same. Fundamentally, everything is terrible and people have to embark on a long journey by foot to try and find salvation, which is what I'm not actually not giving that much away, but by episode four, we are on a long journey by foot to try and find salvation. Where you are besieged by, you know, evil people who are desperately finding their own way to survive, because once society is broken down, we'll all start killing and eating each other. So there is nothing at all after four episodes unfamiliar about it. That said, I don't mind it. I don't mind the way it's done. I'm grateful for the episodes are relatively short. They seem to be clocking in at around about 37 minutes, which seems quite civilised to me. It means you get two in an evening and still have time to watch other things. The other thing that slightly confuses me, and it's true of almost all post-apocalyptic things, is where do they get the hairdressers? Because there is always quality hairdressing in post-apocalyptic dramas. In this one, Simone, the young woman who goes into the bunker with long hair and then... I'm not giving that much away if you haven't watched anything. 6 years later, comes out with a really, really nice bob. Like Maggie in The Walking Dead. Always has a really,
she's had
really
time
nice
to
bob.
Teach herself to do it, hasn't she? I mean, you've got 6 years of trying to just trim the bit that's sticking out in a funny
that's
way.
That's right. But yeah, well, maybe her brother, who's also in the bunker, Rasmus, and there's always someone called Rasmus in a Danish drama. Maybe Rasmus has become a highly trained barber. Maybe the computer technology in the bunker contained lessons on hairdressing, if you like to be
stranded. You've got to do something when you chop below the earth for 6 years. And also, you'll need a trade when society reassembles itself, and we'll always need hairdressers. So, I mean, I quite enjoyed it. I found the moment when the apocalypse occurs to be really well mounted, and actually quite disturbing, quite frightening. I like the spin on the idea that you know, it's both a natural and a man-made disaster at the same time. But yeah, it is. It's a big old trope fest, isn't it? It's a big old, you know, trapped below the earth, kids without parents, Lord of the Flies, the long journey. To me, the interesting thing about it is, how Danish is it? Does it feel like a different thing because it's Danish? What did you think, Sean?
What I felt was the reason why I don't think it's working for us around the table is that this should be hinging on the relationship between the sister and the brother. And what we get is a very sort of cornflakes advert. She's looking after him. He sometimes has a bit of a meltdown. He doesn't know where he is. She's the older sister to his younger brother. There's no tension there. There's no bits where they don't get on unless they're just trying to escape. There were no extra nuances between their relationship. It's very, very flat. And I only saw episode one, so that may change. That's why it just didn't come to life for me. And I felt claustrophobic, obviously, because they're in a bunker. I felt sick of post-apocalyptic programmes and dystopian futures. So it's either me or they're all dystopian. All programmes now are going to be dystopian because we're all doomed.
Were post-apocalyptic futures more interesting when we didn't live in a pre-apocalyptic present? Was it when things were comfortable? We like these things.
Nothing is ever comfortable. We always think we're close to doom, but I'm fed up of seeing it on the TV, and I just felt these people want to frighten me and make me feel uncomfortable, and I don't want to. I want to see something else, or just that human relationship I didn't think was explored enough.
Let's have a bit of music. As always, we invite our guests to bring in a tune to play for the listeners. Their editor's recommendation. Justin Quirk, what have you got for us?
We're going all the way back to 1985 with this, but it's a very recent reissue. There's a fantastic reissue label in Manchester, Be With Records. One of those labels, these real kind of little labour of love things, a bit like Light in the Attic, but a Mancunian version where they dig up these things that are going for insane amounts of money on Discogs. Do the God's own work in sort of tracking down the original rights holders and the masters and reissuing them at very, very high quality. And this is a sort of long-lost British electro-funk thing from about 85. It was essentially John Rocker from Freeze of IOU fame under a pseudonym. He was working as Pink Rhythm. I think this was the only track they ever did. It was going for insane amounts of money for the original until recently. Mm. They've now reissued it beautifully in its sort of full colour sleeve and heavy vinyl. This is Pink Rhythm and Melodies of Love.
Was going for a fortune on Discogs, now 89p on the internet. Here it is.
Feeling all I want is you. I knew the minute that you walked into the room. And hey, you look so exciting, you can really move. You got me reeling and I'm spinning round and round. The melodies of love singing from your heart. The songs on your mind, all I want.
Pink Rhythm with Melodies of Love as chosen by Justin Quirk. Now, sticking with music, Beach House are shaping up to be the millennial My Bloody Valentine, with the requisite sonic cathedrals of sound in place, effects pedals set to ethereal, and now special guest Sonic Boom from Spaceman 3 appearing on the record. New album 7 is floaty and indistinct, and the vocals are breathy, but is it any good? We're going to find out after the opening track. This is Dark Spring. House with Dark Spring from their new 7th album, 7. I really hate it when bands do that. I hate it when they call a 3rd album 3. It is total will this do. It is like, you know, or making your 9th album eponymous. No, make a decision. And there's loads of good titles here. They could have called the album Drunk in LA or Girl of the Year or Lose Your Smile. Michael Hamm, what did you think of this album?
Well, it operates to such a formula. I think the only question is whether it's done well or not. I mean, we've all heard 15,000 albums that sound like this. And I think Beach House do it well. I think at their best, they do something so fragile it's barely there, but it's the detailing that makes the song shine. Yeah. So Pay No Mind, the second track on the album, I mean, it's a succession of some of the most obvious chord changes you might hear in that kind of shoegazy music. Mm-hmm. But the things they add onto it, so there's a kind of bassy hum of synthesizer, there's these sparkles of guitar that sound like they're taken from an early 80s factory record, and then towards the end the voice becomes double tracked, and there's I don't know what the instrument is in the last 30 seconds. It sounds a bit like a glockenspiel or something, but it's not. But this kind of pring sound that I think is rather lovely. But the incremental addition of detail I think makes the song shine. Now that said, you listen to too much of this and it's a bit like kind of bathing in school dinner blancmange. It's so gloopy and saccharine that you just want to get out of it. But I think there are enough changes of pace in there and changes of texture to make it worthwhile. Which is the track Dive, which kind of ups the tempo. It has those 16th note guitars going, it's a welcome change and gives some oomph. But one of the big problems I always have with this kind of music is the voice, you know, that kind of blank affectless voice that has been a constant in indie for the last 30 years, which means that you can never actually hear what anyone is singing. Barely make out a lyric, which is a shame, because Victoria Legrand told the singer of Beach House, told Noisy the other day, that on 7 for me there's a force, and it's not weak and it's not small, it's not feminine or masculine, it's an embodiment of energy. And I think that's what we're feeling as humans on a basic level in our own lives, me as a woman just going through the changes that are constantly occurring and examining. Yeah, but I can't get that from the record.
Prime rock star bollocks, isn't it? Prime.
What I get from the record is a lovely selection of sounds that have almost no meaning because the vocals provide no context. But I do think they do it well.
Yeah, they're a lovely collection of sounds. I too was thinking, what does this mean, and does it even matter if it doesn't mean anything at all? Justin, what did you think?
Very sort of similar to you two, I think. It's good pop, but I don't think it's great. There's a slightly academic quality to this kind of music where you get it sometimes, you see these sort of bands and you think, if I sort of had a certain degree of musical proficiency, and if you fed in a certain kind of record collection, this is roughly what would come out at the other end of it. There's not a great deal that, as Michael says, sets it apart from, I think, a lot of these other bands that seem kind of machine tooled for this kind of 6, 7 p.m. slot at a festival when the sun's going down. And I do wonder, is this surfeit of music a result of this enormous surfeit of music festivals. And there's a lot of those kind of Sunday on the slots that need filling, and a lot of American teen shows that need this kind of thing to play over the closing credit. It's sort of interesting that, I mean, you mentioned like Sonic Boom being on it. I mean, I used to love like Spectrum and that sort of thing, and it's sort of like that with the edges sanded off. It's kind of that with, I don't know, anti-anxiety drugs rather than sort of really nasty heroin in Northampton. And it's sort of odd, I think, as a listener being, and this sort of happened a few times with things we're reviewing today, being old enough to hear sort of things from your youth being recontextualised. And it really made me think that you can make a decent case for the most influential album possibly the last 35 years being Disintegration by The Cure, certainly in American music. I think a record that's had an enormous influence, and yet you almost, and was colossal at the time, and you almost hear nowhere nowadays. I can't remember the last time I heard that when I was out or someone put it on. Mm. And you think, and there's this swathe of these bands that have clearly kind of come downstream of that music, but, you know, they obviously parlayed it to this sort of stadium size by having fairly rock solid pop songs, you know, as the structure that it was all built around, which I think is often what's missing with something like this Beach House record. Is, as Michael said, it's, if you basically understand kind of music theory, you go, okay, that started in B minor, I sort of know where it's going from here, and you can tell where it's going to modulate.
I don't know anything about music theory. I'm a music journalist.
But you could still guess just if you've listened to enough music. If something starts at that point, you go, I sort of know where this is going now. Yeah. And it's, again, it's all about the feel rather than the tune. So it's completely unoffensive. I suspect if I heard it again in the background somewhere next week, I'd be like, oh, you know, did I hear that before? It slightly just washes into one.
Sean, what is it about heat-hazy music that equates with smacky-sounding music? Why is it? Well, yeah, this is because there's a track like this appears on a, you know, there'll be a track like this on every sort of second Primal Scream album, and there'll be one or two on every other Chemical Brothers album, and it's quite nice when you get that zonked-out feel in the middle of a load of other stuff.
Yeah, but I think Justin's right. It's more your GP giving you some antidepressants and everything going a bit blancmange, as Michael said as well, rather than actually smack, 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 or, you know, or well, let's have a bit of a crack pipe. My problem is, and it's interesting to say that Cure and Disintegration, you've got an album title that's Disintegration, so you've got somewhere to go with it. You go, OK, these are going to be songs about everything falling apart. You get an album, as we're saying, called Seven. You don't know whether the songs are happy or sad, or they're drugged up, or they're a natural high man. You don't know. And it's, they're called Beach House. OK, so I can get that. And, yeah, if I was watching Sunset and there was, you know, the waves rolling in. But if I'm in Leicester in a corner shop and I've got it on my headphones and I was walking around North London, Balls Pond Road, Beach House, it didn't work. It really, you know, it's hard. It's just sort of rudderless, I think, and there are no hooks, and I just found it a sludge in the end. But it sounds nice, but it carries on sounding nice and sludgy.
I sometimes wonder whether this is actually a feature, not a bug, of a huge swathe of contemporary music, not just this kind of alternative rock, but a lot of other stuff as well, in the sense that, you know, it's actually a bonus now if music doesn't mean anything. If it's an accessory, if you can slot it into your world and make it fit in somehow.
I disagree.
I think because people seem to like music that does not stand out and say, this is what we're saying.
Do you think the death of tribalism, you know, the death of musical tribalism has contributed to this, to people knowing that you can't, unless you're in, you know, a super specialist genre like metal or, you know, extreme techno or something, you can't form an audience entirely of your tribe in the way that you used to be able to 30 years ago. Therefore, you do have to cut across audiences, you do have to file off edges in order to appeal to everyone. I don't know.
But we live in a polarised society, surely.
Well, we live in a polarised politically society. Yes. We don't live in a musically polarised society.
But why isn't
really
music then reflecting that?
I don't know. People seem to like a bit of everything now, and I think there's probably something in the idea that, you know, the best thing you can do is offend the minimum number of people.
Maybe it's shuffle, because we use shuffle, everything's got to blend seamlessly in. I think, you can't have the sharp edges.
I think Andrew's got a point in that. I did sort of wonder, as, you know, kind of grand theory, is the thing with a lot of the stuff we're reviewing today, we are in the era where feelings trump facts. And so is stuff which is predicated on, you know, like an emotional responses. Maybe it's the soundtrack for that. I also wonder if there's a, perhaps not cynical, but a commercial imperative that I would guess that a band like Beach House have made far more money from having their music synced into adverts, films, TV things than they have ever made from selling records. And again, I wonder if, you know, there's this swathe of bands, because that's the business model now. You're not going to get rich from selling albums.
It sounds like, more than anything, it doesn't particularly sound like it's evoking a feeling. It's evoking the feeling of having feelings.
Yes.
I'm feeling things really intensely now. Hashtag feels.
This, I think, is actually the most interesting thing about Beach House. The fact that, yeah, they've been going for, what, 12 years now. It's the seventh album. So they predate Spotify. They predate Instagram. And yet what they sound like above all else is an Instagram
group. It's all that stuff.
You know, right down to the name, Beach House. And then having a song on here called A Drunk in LA. Everything about it seems like it's, you know, very specifically targeted for a filter.
Hot dog legs, isn't it?
I don't even know whether it's targeted at that. It seems to be unconscious. That's just the world that they live in. I mean, and I actually did enjoy it. I'm not sort of slagging it off and saying, what is this awful kind of commercially designed stuff? No. I don't think it is commercially designed. I think instinctively, this is the kind of music you create now. You see yourself in the sort of slightly left of centre space, slightly left of the commercial centre, which is actually, of course, the absolute commercial centre, because nobody wants to be mainstream anymore.
Sometimes the way I try and think about music to distance myself from it is think, would Patrick Bateman kill someone quite brutally to it? And I think he would with Beach House. It has that very bland thing, and that, you know, American Psycho 2, that's what he's going to be brutally raping and murdering to.
It's kind of harsh on Beach House, that.
Sorry, Beach House. I quite like it.
There's the Alba poster campaign full quote.
Anyway, well, let's move on. Let's have a change of gear, shall we? Having just frankly libeled Beach House there, I want to make it absolutely clear, you should not murder anybody to the sound of the Beach House album. We're going to have that change of gear. Michael Hann, what track have you brought in to play to the listeners?
I brought in Future Bay, B-A-E, not B-A-Y, by Jimothy Lacoste.
Jimothy. Is that a character from Modern Family?
Jimothy is not his real name. Like, his real name I know because I think a couple of years ago he was part of my daughter's group of friends. His real name is Timothy.
Okay.
But what interests me about Jimothy Lacoste is not his music, which doesn't do a lot for me, but the fact that, you know, we often talk about how there's no generation gap left anymore. There is nothing to shock, nothing to be unfamiliar with. But there is a generation gap, and it's determined by the consumption of culture through technology. And, you know, Jimothy Lacoste is one of those people who no one over about 18 has heard of. But, I mean, literally not heard of. It's not, vaguely aware of him. It's, who's he? But kids follow in enormous numbers. He's sort of a YouTuber. He makes videos, but also makes music as well. And I was talking to an A&R, a label head at one of the big labels the other week, who's talking about Jimothy Lacoste, saying, I think he's terrible. Heard him through my kids. My kids started going on about him. And we're really interested in him now because he has such a following. I'm sure we can do something with him. Now, when even people running record labels are hearing about music because their kids follow these people on YouTube, I think that is evidence of a generation gap. I think it does exist, and there's scores of this stuff. My son is always going on about these things. I was talking about Jimothy Lacoste to my daughter yesterday. And she was saying,
Jimothy Lacoste, like, really young then as well?
Yeah, my daughter's 17, so he'll be 17 or 18.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
She's saying the whole point of it is that you don't get it. I mean, it's not meant to be offensive. It's not you don't get it in the way that 40-somethings in 1976 didn't get the Sex Pistols. It's just, it does not speak your language. It is full of references that you're not meant to be understood by you.
Well, this is going to go in an absolute storm with our well-known millennial listenership and Big Mouth, all of whom are just basically trying to cram for the GCSEs now.
I just want to make plain again that I am not repping for this music. I just think it's an interesting thing.
Well, world of Big Mouth, see what you think. This is Future Bay by Jimothy Lacoste.
This quick song goes out to my future bae. Bae, I know you out there. I'm gonna look for you soon. Soon. Listen.
Was Future Bay by Jimothy Lacoste, as chosen by Michael Hann. And speaking of the future, on the 19th of May 1978, Kraftwerk released The Man Machine, the capsule for all electronic music that followed. The sound was entirely synthetic and self-contained. The band, the producers, the instruments and the studio were all kind of the same thing. And the look, pale, androgynous, inhuman and fragile, pretty much set the template for synthesised pop music for the next 40 years. Even more than its predecessors, Trans-Europe Express and Radioactivity, Die Mensch Machine gave us Robopop. And we've decided to celebrate it by choosing the best and worst robots in pop. After we've heard this from The Man Machine, this is Kraftwerk with The Robots.
You're charging your battery. And
Robots by Kraftwerk, 40 years old this year, from a time when an IBM 5110 computer would cost the equivalent of $35,000. Great times. Before we get into the thorny question of the best and worst robots in pop, Justin Quirk, we are right to venerate the man machine, are we not?
Oh, it cannot be venerated enough. For all my metal leanings, I'm a huge Kraftwerk fan. Being a complete snob, I'd obviously go for Radioactivity rather than the man machine. But no, they are... You know, they're the absolute full package. It's not just... It's glistening perfect pop music. It's put together in... It was so out of time for then, and it still sounds out of time now.
Yeah.
There was a great theory that someone was talking about. I was from a documentary a couple of years ago, and they were saying, you know, everyone talks about the Sex Pistols gig at the Free Trade Hall in 76, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything that flowed downstream from that. And someone said... The one that gets forgotten is that I think Kraftwerk played at Sheffield University 3 months later.
Yeah.
And it's the Sheffield electronic equivalent. And they're like, in attendance at that gig were everyone from, you know, OMD, Heaven 17, Cabaret Voltaire, all those.
Clock DVA.
Yeah. And that's sort of, in argument of what it gave birth to, I think you could say that was probably the more significant gig in terms of where the future was going and what we sound like.
I would go one further. I would say it was April 1975 when Kraftwerk appeared on Tomorrow's World, showing you how to play drums that you've made out of knitting needles and electric contacts. I think that was more important.
Is that the one where it looks like everything's been wired up really strangely? That's how they're going to electrocute themselves.
Yeah, they're all going to burst into flames at any second. Yeah.
But it's the whole package as well, in that it's not just... the music, but the look is so incredible. And it was, you know, for a band who, I say, were very, you know, avant-garde and were from this sort of like nerdy kind of anti-pop culture, their grasp of the entire package, everything down to, you know, the typography, the way it looked, the way it felt, the way they repackaged and repurposed things, it still looks futuristic now, which is, you know, for something that moves as fast as pop music, is incredibly difficult to do.
It's also cemented synth pop as European. You know, synthpop will be the European thing, and you see everything up to the kind of spoof Kraftwerk band in The Big Lebowski, who basically looks like Kraftwerk. Yes. We are nihilists from Germany. Michael, firstly, are you a Kraftwerk fan?
I am a Kraftwerk fan, although I've become slightly conflicted in recent times. Clearly, there is no argument with the records at all. But I think in recent times that Kraftwerk have kind of betrayed the whole point of Kraftwerk. In that they've simply become a nostalgia act. They're a museum piece now. It's going to watch Kraftwerk is no different from going to watch Kiss. It's like watching pantomime. You know exactly what is going to happen at every point throughout the show. And it's the same kind of beery blokes who, as the robots come onto the stage for the encore.
Well, it's Andrew.
But that is me. But I will take you back to Bestival when they played Bestival with the 3D show. And there's a bunch of 65, 70 year old Germans on stage. And there was a gang of girls next to me who must have been in their early 20s. And they were A, going berserk, and B, going, who is this? Where are they from? What are they all about? And of course, I mansplained it in detail to them, and they were like, oh, really? They've been going for ages, have they? And it is possible for people to discover this anew. I take your point that nothing has changed in the world of Kraftwerk. And actually, when you look at the Man Machine, this is basically the end. Because after this, they do Computer World, which has got one or two good tracks on it, Electric Cafe, which is rubbish, and that's kind of it.
I disagree there. I think the last great thing they did was the much maligned The Mix, which I know is greatest hits, but actually that was the first time where they took the past and recontextualised it. I much prefer the version of the robots on The Mix to the version of Man Machine.
The housey version, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like it's adapted to the times, but everything they've done since then has been based on The Mix. You know, the live show has not changed since they first introduced the 3D stuff, and when was that? About 8 or 9 years ago, and even then, that was just 3D version of the stuff that was 2D 15 years ago.
Well, the Man Machine, it's a weird thing because it's like a 6-track album. It's only 36 minutes long, but I think 5 of the 6 tracks are mainstays of the set that they've been hawking around for the past 15 years. It basically is they reached their zenith and they've kind of stayed there, really.
Isn't this also? I mean, I share Michael's thing that I'm always very wary of going to see old bands because I hate that thing of like you say. Beery old blokes just kind of reliving their youth. But equally, there's maybe a fundamental misunderstanding there that Kraftwerk aren't the band, Kraftwerk were the technology themselves, and technology does become obsolete. And maybe there's an argument that going to see them now is like going to look at like an Apple One computer somewhere, in that, you know, they are to a degree frozen in that time because, yeah, they were the technology themselves.
Although they have actually rebuilt the technology over and over and over again and used... The weird thing about it is, like, there's no rock band out there, with the exception of Brian May, that built their own guitar and built their own drum kit and built their own bass guitar from bits. Mm. And they built the technology that they used to make this music and continue to rebuild it and write their own software. They're engineers as well as studio people, which is interesting.
What's interesting, though, I think, is that, you know, you feel like there should be a Kraftwerk for the current moment, a group who are obsessed with technology, not just in the way that it produces music, but in its social effect. You know, we live in a world where hackers and bots can transform democracy. We live in a world where we're being surveyed by computers the whole time. You know, there's such rich material there for a new Kraftwerk. In a way, I wish that, you know...
But it won't be in music, will it? Those kids... I mean, there's young artists and things I know who are working with all that material and those ideas and are exploring those sort of contradictions and how can you break technology and what can you do with it. And I think to them, the idea that you'd do that using something as boring and anachronistic to them as music, they'd be like, well, why would you use that as the vehicle in the same way that, you know, Kraftwerk wouldn't have used, I don't know, like live radio broadcasts or something. They would have seen that as just something for a previous generation.
Yeah. I don't see Kraftwerk's folk dance out there. It'll be interesting. Sean, where do you stand on the man machine?
I think it is preserved in aspic, but that was the point. I think it sounds of its time sometimes. I don't think you could say that that's a modern record. No one, as we're saying, would make it now. But the point is that they stopped and they have to rehash what they do. They have to be a tribute act to themselves in that way. We used to put it on when we did the Gur Art Shop. Now I just realised we didn't pay any PRS. people were always quite happy to come into the shop and hear it. And that was the thing. It was a great leveller. Everybody liked Kraftwerk. You put Kraftwerk on and no one would argue about what was on the stereo.
Well, they're basically the Beatles, aren't they?
They often get portrayed as a futuristic band. I don't know why. I think they were always a band who were about the present, about the absolute moment of the present. So the Man Machine is about the development of robotics. Computer World is about the incursion of computers into the wider world. You know, they were never looking at things that were going to happen down the line. They were talking about what was at the cutting edge at that moment. And of course, as you get older, you are no longer at the cutting edge of that moment.
They're taking from futurism and ideas from, you know, the First World War and Hugo Ball and all sorts of artists who were then experimenting with, you know, what are we? Are we machines? That sort of thing. So they were looking back as well and then moving that into pop music.
Mm. I'm going to change my mind. The last great thing they did was definitely Tour de France. Because that is the man machine. That is the human and the bicycle.
Actually,
and biological
record,
and so on. And that sounds, although, yeah, it's like 1983 wild style hip hop, it also sounds completely timeless and completely out of the context.
But that's so wonderful, the way that led over into, you know, it's at Beat Street. There's the famous scene where they play Tour de France and the guy's sweeping up in the shop and he does like the dance routine. And the fact that something that was so Middle European and deracinated and cold had this sort of weird second life in, you know, the Bronx, whatever, you know, in like 1982. And there's an amazing clip I saw somewhere on YouTube of a load of kids breakdancing on a subway to Yellow. And again, you think just these sort of odd moments where these things that were built for a completely different place and time then were sort of reinvented. So maybe the reinvention and the recontextualization wasn't meant to be done by them anyway. You know, they were like source codes that were taken.
I was watching the documentary about Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre on Netflix the other day. And there's a bit in there where I think it's Dre or it might be another hip hop person, but it starts talking about Kraftwerk. You know, obviously we know that Kraftwerk had a huge influence, but someone say, yeah, everyone who knows about hip hop knows this record, and they play a bit of God, I can't remember. Oh,
Trans-Europe Express.
Yeah, Trans-Europe Express. Sorry, my mind went blank there.
It's all right.
And everyone knows that. And treating it as if, this is a hip-hop record, which feeds into just what you were saying. Mm. But I found that actually oddly moving. Yeah. I'm saying this is a hip-hop record.
Let's see the best and worst robots in pop, quickly. Quirk.
Best robot. Eddie on the cover of Iron Maiden's 1986 Somewhere in Time. This is the one of the Blade Runner sort of futuristic tableau where he's wearing these giant radioactive underpants and taking out all comers with stun guns.
Worst robot?
Worst robot, the useless intergalactic phone operator from the video to the Ra Band's Clouds Across the Moon. Wow. This guy has one job, which is to connect the lonely housewife with her space oil rigger husband. Completely fails to do it because he's too busy ineptly body popping on what looks like a soundstage at Thames TV in Teddington in 1982.
Inept body popping, we love it. Sean, what have you got?
Best one's Gary Newman. Mm-hmm. Surely the best robot pop is Gary Newman, sitting very, very quietly, looking pale, frightened of everything because he's got Asperger's, in a room and singing about it. Apparently, Our Friends Electric is about robot prostitutes.
Really?
Yeah, went to number one. It's about he's very pleased.
So he's invented incel. He's invented sex bots. Oh, God. What did you do that for, Gary?
And I quite like the fact that he's right-wing and you're just not allowed to be right-wing.
He's not that right-wing.
I think he used to be, and then the enemy told him off and he stopped.
I don't think he really is that right-wing in real
life. There was a point when he did say, oh, I'm a Tory. And everyone went, oh, God. And you're so not allowed to be a Tory. I just think that's hilarious. Hmm. I don't think he is anymore.
Do you think all robots are conservatives?
I think they're all deeply
C-3PO is definitely a bit that way.
Shut up, you're a robot.
Shut up, you're a robot. What's the worst robot in pop, Sean?
Metal Mickey.
Why is that?
6 hit singles, and still they're all awful. Actually, they were quite good. And they've got the shuffle beat. They've got this glam rock behind them. And he does I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is actually quite a good cover. And it's weird. Obviously, it's really weird because it was Metal Mickey and he wasn't holding your hand. There's a sort of funny subtext to that. So again, robot prostitutes. Here we go. Life is a circle.
Sounds great. Michael Hamm, what have you got for best robot in pop?
The best robot in pop is Compressor Head, which is a Berlin-based project done by an artist called Frank Barnes and two scientists called Marcus Kolb and Stock Plum. What a great name, Stock Plum. And they put together a 3-piece robot band, programmed through MIDI but playing real instruments. And of course, what they play, Andrew, is heavy metal.
Of course,
there is no music more robotic
because
than heavy metal.
It's Germany, that's why. Mm. Who's the worst robot in pop?
Because sticking with the hard rock theme, the worst robot in pop is the robot Marilyn Monroe on the cover of Aerosmith's Just Press Play. It's like kind of a 12-year-old fantasizer about what would be the coolest thing in the world? Like a robot Marilyn Monroe.
So Marilyn Monroe.
Whoa!
There you go.
So it's the robot is doing the Marilyn Monroe on the cover of 7 Year Itch with the from 7 Year Itch with the skirt blowing up, and what you end up with is something that looks like a terrible robot and is completely unsexy too. So the worst of both worlds.
I can't believe there's such a thing as an unsexy robot. The best robot in pop for me, I'm going to go with Herbie Hancock's robots in the Rocket video, because Daft Punk's too obvious. Just because that was so, I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was ridiculously exciting, and it was a huge departure for Herbie Hancock to sort of start making this clattery inhuman thing that still had a massive, massive, huge, enormous helpings and servings of funk in it. And the worst was, it's probably Taken Talk, isn't it? Getting Kraftwerk wrong. Plus, mime is always awful. Mime should be expunged. Don't pretend to be stuck in a telephone box, whether you're human or a robot or anything like that.
Also, surely robots miming defeats the point that robots can't speak anyway. So what they're miming continuously.
Yeah, there's probably an entire episode of Westworld to be done on that, I would have thought. Should the man-machine be on the national curriculum? I think it should. Should be
no, it would ruin it. School's rubbish. Let them teach rubbish at school.
Okay, fair enough.
No, but have it in German GCSE and give them the German version, so they're getting some language skills.
Mm. Well, actually, you get quite some good German. You get some quite good German language skills at the live show, where all the German notes are put up for you, so that you can écouter and répéter, except in German.
More music, shall we? Mm-hmm. We've got a couple more albums vying for the position of Sound of the Summer this week. One is by turban-wearing DJ Kose, the weirdest man in dance music, according to Resident Advisor. He's the chap who turned Lapsley's Operator into the disco banger of 2016, and his third album, Knock Knock, is out now. The other is Singularity by John Hopkins, who started out working with Brian Eno, found himself contributing to Coldplay's Viva La Vida, and now makes widescreen Sky at Night style spacey ambient scary, that was me adding that bit, music. Which one will accompany your beachside Mai Tai this summer? Let's have a taster of both. This is Seeing Aliens by DJ Kose, followed by John Hopkins with Everything Connected.
That was Seeing Aliens by DJ Cozy, followed by John Hopkins with Everything Connected. Let's talk about DJ Cozy first. This is a huge and a very long album, 80 minutes. Guest voices by Rasheen Murphy, Kurt Wagner of Lamb Chop, Jose Gonzalez, and one of Arrested Development of all people. Justin Quirk, what did you make of the Cozy album?
He's not a soul of brevity, is he?
No, he isn't.
On and on and on. It's these are both surprisingly sort of hard on the ears, but in very different ways. One good, one bad. I found a lot about the Cozy album quite difficult to listen to, in that there's a lot of bits where, like Bonfire Trait, it's all slightly out of sequence. It's sonically quite abrasive in sort of different points, but not in a way that it feels like it's sort of pushing the envelope, more in a way that it feels like they've built in these kind of deliberate irritations. It's got a slightly zany quality running through some of it that reminded me a little of things like those old sort of Lemon Jelly albums where there's sort of things kind of dropping in to disturb you. It also suffers a lot in the... I mean, it's not just got one good track. The single Pickup is obviously fantastic. This is one that I think everyone has heard by now. It's in the same sort of wheelhouse as Stardust. Music Sounds Better With You. It's got that sort of chopped, kind of very filtered disco thing. It's built around that great Gladys Knight sample. Also, side point, Gladys Knight, the most underrated voice in music of her generation. And has been,
she's probably ready for a reinvention.
Well, Burt Bacharach, there was a great interview with him on Radio 4 last year, and they said, who's the best singer you ever worked with? And he said, hands down, Gladys Knight. And he said, she doesn't even have a record deal at the moment. And he said, I cannot believe she's overlooked. But there's obviously, so the single Pickup is absolutely fantastic. Illumination, the one with Rasheen Murphy, I think you could put her on anything and it would sound fantastic. But those two tracks, I think, have a real halo effect on the rest of the record, in that I think if you remove them, and particularly if you remove Pickup, I'm not sure there's a huge amount going on there.
What did you think, Michael?
Well, I'd managed to avoid Pickup before listening to this album. I was listening to it on headphones while doing some writing, so I didn't have the track titles in front of me. And honestly, I've never heard an album where which track was the single was so blindingly obvious. You know, once Pickup came, I was like, all right, this has got to be the single. All right, go back to Spotify. Yes, that's Pickup. That's the one everyone's talking about. It won't surprise you to learn that this is not music that's generally enters my consciousness in any great way. It is so long. The John Hopkins album is really long as well. I mean, there's 3 hours of listening between those two records. The John Hopkins record didn't feel like it was taking a vast chunk out of my life. The DJ Cozy album felt like I'd binged watched an entire Netflix series that I didn't even like.
But do you think, sort of connected with what we were talking about earlier, that maybe we're listening to it too closely and what it's for is sticking on?
It should be in the background,
yeah.
It's
ambient. It's
Yeah, it's a new meaning of ambient, isn't it? Because it's not music that's designed to be that amniotic wash of old ambient, but it's music that you can't pay too much attention to because it will irritate
Ian Eno's
his lesser known brother.
Ian Eno's original conception of ambient music was that you would play it quietly and it would interact with the sounds of your house, of the cat and the doorbell and the thing in the street and the, you know, and the phone going off. It was there to be, literally, to be ambient, not to be big loud whale noises floating you off to your own subconscious. But I think you're right, this is a different kind of...
But I think the Cozy one doesn't work in that way, in that I say that it feels like there's too many things built in.
It's too obtrusive, isn't it?
It's waving its hand around and trying to get you to look at it. Whereas the John Hopkins one... I thought sonically, it's surprisingly kind of hard and granular sounding, but... in a way that I really like. It's very textured. It's got this really nice sort of analogue feel that you don't get in a lot of electronic music now. It doesn't feel like it's been done with all the same sort of patches and plugins. And when it reminded me of a lot of things that I used to listen to that you don't really hear referenced quite though. There's that Neon Pattern drum track feels like, you know, stuff like Pole and people like that. It's that weird sort of like quite minimal electronic dub, like basic channel sort of stuff. It feels much more cohesive as an album. He clearly is very in love with all this kind of old modular equipment and knows how it works.
It was screaming Fender Rhodes at me.
There's quite a bit of that. But there's things like, he's got these lovely sort of like bubbly synths. And weirdly, two things that really came to mind, which again were enormous when I was a kid, but you don't hear a great deal now. Future Sound of London, that sort of early 90s kind of bubbly analog sort of tracks feel. And Dub My Bass in My Head Man, the Underworld album. There's a couple of tracks in it that really sound like that sort of dirty, epic, kind of long, drifty stuff. And it was interesting hearing things I remembered from then being kind of brought back again.
We're getting a bit tight for time. Sean, what did you think of Cozy and John Hopkins?
Cozy,
Thought, is this coming up music or chilling out music? Didn't know where it lay. Thought, that's Ibiza, that on a plate, but I'm not sure when I'd listen to it. John Hopkins, I'd really, really try, because I thought, he's really trying with this album. I'm going to really try and listen to it. Listen to it in lots of different situations, and the weirdest one is listening to it on headphones really, really loudly in a park on a very hot day. Scared the living daylights out of me. Yeah, I was quite interested in my reaction. That ambient We're All Going to Die music, which I always think Eno's a bit like music to have your legs waxed to. If you play it loud and you start really hearing it, oh, it may have been just me and my Diet Coke. It was quite disturbing. I was interested in how disturbing it sounded. I actually like to listen to it quite a lot to sort of get into it. And, as Justin says, sort of feel those textures. I thought it was really interesting, but it was giving me completely the opposite effect that I think it meant to.
See, this is exactly my kind of stuff, and I found both of them kind of hard to connect with, really, emotionally hard to connect with, because the Cozy one is enormously uneven and doesn't really get to the point. And I find the John Hopkins album really cold. I think, you know, to treat electronic music as this sort of, this distant thing is kind of, you know, that's almost the expected thing. You know, it's there to be emotionless and not to connect with you. And I sort of think he's got the talent and the skills and the ability to create something that kind of reaches out to you and seems to want to stay distant. Also, I don't need any more piano etudes.
Oh, I like the Hopkins album, but I don't know whether that's because John Hopkins is always one of those people who's spoken about as, no, honestly, this is the kind of dance music that people like you will like.
Who don't like dance music.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, subconsciously you're primed for it. But I listened to that and thought, this makes sense to me. I thought the way the textures run into each other was good. It kind of made sense. Whereas with Cozy, whatever we call it, the textures were so jarring that it just... Every time a new track came on, it made me go...
I just come back to what I always think about these things is I just want more disco. I just want more disco.
More Gladys Knight.
More Gladys Knight, yes. So that is another hour closer to the inevitable heat death of the universe. We're almost at the end of the show, and that means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a glass of fermented mare's milk over the weekend? Justin Quirk.
I wanted to flag up the Stephen Lawrence film on BBC. It's still on the iPlayer for another week or so after we go out, I think. It's a really, really fantastic retelling of a sort of widescreen retelling of the entire story around the lead up to his murder, what happened, and what the aftermath of it was. It's one of those things that you watch and go, okay, that's what I pay the license fee for. It's that sort of documentary level that only really the BBC does, where they have the talking heads are everyone from Theresa May downwards. The thing that I thought was really interesting was I was, you know, 17 at the time in London when it happened. It was incredibly evocative of what living in London at that period was like. All these weird details around the case you had sort of forgotten about. It's incredibly nuanced in the retelling. It avoids all the kind of obvious open goals. And the thing that really jumped out at me was what a weird kind of fairground mirror of a case it was, in that you had a lot. It revealed this sort of side of London and, you know, relationship with the police that I think if you're someone like me or most people, you were probably completely unaware of. But then conversely, this succession of fairly terrible people in the film, like Theresa May, Paul Dacre, these really old school Cockney wanker CID types, who came across as fairly awful people in every other respect, but in this one case became sort of humanised and showed this completely different side of themselves that they have never shown before or since. And just what a deeply sort of strange, transformative case it was. But it's a really astonishing piece of filmmaking that could have unravelled very badly, and I would recommend everyone watch it.
And it's still on the iPlayer?
It's on for another week, I think, after we go out.
OK. Michael Hamm, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
I've become obsessed with The Americans. The sixth and final season started a few weeks ago on ITV4. And I love spy things. And I'd meant to watch this from the beginning and never had. So, oh, God, it's going to go, isn't it? So I found it on Amazon Prime. And I watched the first five seasons and I'm now up to speed with The Americans. This is in the last 3 weeks. So I've watched five seasons and I think four episodes of the final season. And it's astonishing. It's such brilliant TV. It's not without its shortcomings. Basically, each week there is a kind of action scenario, which I find quite tiresome. But what it's really about... It's about the American spies Russian spies passing themselves off as ordinary American suburbanites, and what it's really about is self-hatred and morality and lying to oneself, not just to everyone around you, but the lies you create for yourself to justify what you do. It is such transfixing television. There are some episodes in series 4 where a completely innocent American woman realises that her life has been duped by one of these Russian spies, that are some of the most heartbreaking things I've ever seen on TV. It is so great.
Oh, so watch it while you can. Sean, I kind of trod on your closing time chat by asking about Eurovision earlier, didn't I? But have you got all the Eurovision obsessions going on at the moment?
Well, Eurovision is happening on Saturday. This is the day we go out. And I do live draw on the Twitter, which is drawing everything live for charity on Saturday. So tune into the Twitter and I will give you the Just Giving page, because I want to raise more for Great Ormond Street than I've ever done. This is the fifth year running where I do it, and it all gets quite exciting. And we all have a drink and I draw everything. And you can also win one of these watercolour postcards as well. So it's justgiving.com/fundraising/Sean-Superman. And you can go to the page and you can pledge and you can write comments and be nice.
Live drawing Eurovision.
Yes, live
draw.
Could
be better? Well, I've only got a little short one, but it's about Marvel, you'd be amazed to learn.
Yay.
The trailer for Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is the very small-scale next Marvel movie, is coming out after the hugeness of Infinity War. And there's a character, the gist of it is Ant-Man is a bit of a failure and a bit of a screw-up. So he's been given a sidekick, the Wasp, and she is much more competent. She really knows what she's doing. But there's a little tiny bit in the trailer where they introduce Lawrence Fishburne as a character called Bill Foster. And I remember him from the 70s when he was Black Goliath, when black characters always had black at the start of their name. And he was the black giant man. And I just thought, my heart soared when I saw this very minor character being given their moment in the Marvel movies. And it made me think, what's going to happen when they run out? How am I going to feel when they've done them all? How am I going to feel when Squirrel Girl has had her 2 minutes in the movies and it's all finished? I'll feel like the end of an era has come.
How many are left who haven't been done yet? I mean, we're down to like the real B team now.
We really are getting down to the Ipswich Town reserves of the Marvel Universe at the moment. And I mean, I think the next step is they're going to have to start creating from whole cloth brand new things to insert into this, because when you're down to, I mean, God bless Bill Foster, Black Goliath, and I'm totally there for him, but you realise that you're kind of getting to the back of the cupboard there quite a bit.
Are there any that you wouldn't make the case for? Are there any that are so lame they couldn't be rehabilitated into a film?
Oh, there's someone like you. Millions of them. Millions of absolutely atrocious.
Who are the worst?
Oh, God. Pastepot Pete, his job is he was a villain. His thing was he had a gun that squirted glue. Pastepot Pete. There you go. Not really.
That could
really
work.
Go over it.
Got arrested
good
on
writing.
His first day on the
that
job.
Yeah.
Well, then, but was that when someone from Beano got a job at Marvel and they were just there for a week before getting
Stan
sacked?
This was Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. This is early days of Fantastic Four. But, I mean, I mentioned Squirrel Girl, and she was a standing joke for years. They brought her back, and they did her in a kind of humorous YA style, and now she's quite a big deal. There's a lot of kind of, because she is a girl superhero who doesn't care, making it in a man's world. And kind of quite, literally empowering. Get it? See? Literally superpowering. So there we go, and that's the end of the show. Thanks to our special guest, Michael Hann. What are you up to next?
I'm off to just try and obliterate the fact that you managed to squeeze Marvel into this, which I thought we'd gone superhero free for now. I'm going to try and obliterate that from my mind. And then I'm going to go home and I'm going to transcribe an interview with Johnny Marr.
Oh, that's nice.
What a great, great, gracious man Johnny Marr
is to
interview.
He's a lovely fellow, isn't he? Yeah. He's a lovely, lovely fellow. Justin Quirk, what have you got on? How can the listeners support Nothing But A Good Time again?
Go to unbound.com and search for the phrase good time and... Mm-hmm. It'll be the first book that comes up. You can see the film trailer there that tells you what the book's all about, and you can pledge hard.
If you're looking for a good time, hem hem. Right, thank you to everybody for coming. Do come back whenever you like. Thanks as ever to Sean Pattenden for keeping us on track. And hail to the returning producer, Sophie Black, to the Big Mouth setup. Don't forget, you can hear this show and all of our past podcasts at audioboom.com/bigmouth. If you want to support the show, of course, you can buy us that virtual pint via Patreon at patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next week.